The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about how dogs are not mind readers. Dave, I always thought dogs could tell the moods of people.
Well, Rob, this story isn't really about telling moods. It's about whether dogs can actually intuit what we're thinking. And that doesn't really mean reading our minds, but it means having a general idea of what our intentions are.
So not whether we're happy or sad, but what we're about to do.
Something like that. This study has to do with something called theory of mind. And what theory of mind basically is do you understand that someone else's mind is separate from your own? Do you understand that other people have their own thoughts and motivations? And it sounds like a very simple concept and something that's very intuitive for us. But it turns out that young children don't have a theory of mind. For example, if you ask a toddler, maybe a 3 or 4 year old, to hide a toy behind the couch and his mother doesn't know where he hid the toy, but you ask the toddler, does mommy know where you hid the toy? The toddler will usually say yes. And that's because he just sort of assumes that everything he knows, his mother knows, because he hasn't started to make that distinction between their two minds. But obviously, as we grow up, we realize people don't have the same mind that we do. And eventually that child is going to say, no, mommy doesn't know where that toy is. But proving this theory of mind in non-humans has been very difficult. There's been some studies done with chimpanzees, but they've been fairly inconclusive.
So why move on to experiments with dogs and not stay with chimps?
Well, the idea with dogs, Rob, is that we've been living with dogs for thousands of years. And the idea is if we've been living together for so long, we maybe know something about how each other thinks. And so the researchers said, well, you know, given that, maybe dogs have a theory of mind when it comes to humans. Maybe dogs can sense, in a sense, what we're thinking.
So how do you test whether a dog has a theory of mind for a person?
Well, as you can guess, it's not very easy to do. What the researchers did in this experiment was they rounded up about 24 dogs, and they matched them with two types of people, somebody that they called a helpful person or somebody they called a deceptive person. And here's what they did. They made the dog sit by a tree in a park, and they put two buckets not too far away from the dog. And both buckets smelled like food, but only one bucket contained food, and that food was a Frankfurter, so something the dog really wanted. And what they had is they had, in some experiments, the quote-unquote helpful person always stood by the food bowl and pointed to it and said, you know, come over here, you know, there's food over here, something like that. And in other experiments, this deceitful person or this unhelpful person would stand near the empty food bowl and say, come over here, there's food over here. And as you might guess, you know, over the course of the trial, the dogs were really trusting these helpful people. They would run to the buckets that had the food, and they would always sort of be trusting these helpful people. But over the course of the trial, the dogs began less and less to trust these deceitful people. In fact, by about the end of the trial, about 80 to 90% of the time, the dogs were always following the helpful people's instructions. But by the end of the trial, only about 50 to 60% of the time, the dogs were following the deceitful people. So there was about this, you know, 20% difference between the two.
It's not then that they were just associating the helpful person with the food in the same way that they might associate a different shaped bucket with the food.
That's the big question here. I mean, you can sort of infer two possible scenarios from this experiment. You can say, well, dogs just got to know that they could associate one person with food and one person with doesn't have the food. And that has nothing to do with theory of mind. It's just making simple associations. Or you can infer that the dogs were getting insight into how these people were thinking. And they were saying, well, I know these deceitful people are trying to deceive me, so I'm going to avoid what that person says. So the way the researchers tried to tackle this problem was they set up another experiment, and this time they took the humans out of the equation. And instead of humans, they did something like you refer to, Rob. What they did was they took two different color boxes, like a white box and a black box. And let's just say, for the case of simplicity, that the white box was always associated with food, and the black box was always associated with the empty bucket. And what the researchers saw with this box trial was very similar to what they saw with the human trial. The percentage difference between the dogs following this sort of helpful box versus the non-helpful box was also about 20%. And what the researchers say that means is that the dogs really are making these decisions based on associations. They're just associating one thing with food and one thing with non-food. They're not really gaining any insight into what people are thinking. And that indicates that the dogs don't really have what we would consider a theory of mind.
at least according to this experiment.
Exactly.
But another experiment might be out there that would help researchers understand whether dogs have this theory of mind or not.
Well, as you can imagine, Rob, this is a very complicated concept. This is something that's very complicated to test. There's been a lot of ambiguous studies in chimpanzees, and this is really one of the first studies to test this in dogs. So even though this indicates that there doesn't seem to be theory of mind in dogs, I'm sure a lot of dog owners would disagree that their dogs don't really know what they're thinking. And so a lot more experiments really need to be done before we can say for certain whether dogs really know what we're thinking.
Okay. So what other stories have you brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, as you know, dogs are man's best friends. And this next study is about friends and friendships between people. And it's about whether cell phones actually can tell us more about our friendships than we know ourselves.
Cell phones or data from cell phones?
Well, it's data from cell phones. Here's the idea. The idea is that cell phones contain so much information that we never think about. I mean, we're calling people all the time. We're talking to them for certain amounts of times. We're in different locations when we're calling people. These are all things that our cell phones keep track of. And they wanted to figure out, you know, can cell phone data tell us about human relationships without us having to go around and survey everybody and ask them who's your friend and who's not your friend and who do you work with and who don't you work with? Can we just get this information from cell phones? And what they did was they took about 90 students and faculty at MIT, and they gave them all cell phones. And these cell phones had the software on them that would really track in detail, like who the people were calling. This was just when people in the study called each other, you know, who they were calling and where they were when they were calling each other. And what the researchers wanted to find out is, did the data accurately reveal friendships or acquaintances? And they found out that it actually does. When people said, hey, I'm really close friends with person X, that's what the cell phone data revealed. The way they showed friendships on cell phones was that friends tend to call each other. It's not by the amount that you call each other necessarily. It's when you call each other. Friends tend to call each other more when they're off campus and on weekends than just, say, casual acquaintances would. And that's what the data bear out. When people called themselves friends, the cell phone data showed that these people had these calling patterns. But what was really interesting about the data is the cell phone data actually predicted who would become friends before people actually called each other friends. So, Rob, say you and I just consider ourselves acquaintances.
Okay.
And, you know, it turns out that I start calling you more and more when I'm outside of work, and I start calling you more and more on the weekends. If we were both to take a survey during that period, we might still at some point be, we'll say, well, I'm still an acquaintance with Rob. I'm not really a friend. But according to the cell phone data is showing us becoming more and more friendly. And it turns out by the end of the study, we would be calling each other friends on the survey, and the cell phone data would have predicted that months ago.
So this is really a new tool for researchers to use and corroborates qualitative data with quantitative data.
Exactly. And what's really nice about this is a tool that researchers have wanted to use for a long time, but they weren't sure it was going to be accurate. And this study shows, actually about 95% of the time, that the cell phone data accurately reflected these relationships. So it really does give researchers this new tool.
Okay. So last story this week. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, I can't think of a transition here. This last story is about flying ancient reptiles.
Well, I could see why you couldn't think of a transition for that.
Let's just say now for something completely different. This last story is about an ancient runway found for a flying reptile known as a pterosaur. And you may know pterosaurs better by a group of reptiles in this family that are known as pterodactyls.
The large winged, pointy-headed dinosaurs that you see in movies like Jurassic Park?
Well, you're exactly right there, except for dinosaurs. These are technically not dinosaurs. They're just considered flying reptiles. Although they lived at the time of the dinosaurs, they were around about 150 million years ago.
Okay.
Okay. Well, now that we've got that cleared up, Rob, you may have heard about people finding dinosaur footprints and other ancient fossilized footprints. And this usually happens when some creature, you know, steps on something, maybe soft sand, that for some reason or another hardens, it traps the footprint, and this gets preserved for millions of years. Well, this study is the same, but with a twist. Instead of finding footprints, they've actually found what looks like prints from a pterosaur landing. So again, you know, sort of this runway idea, they found the strip of ground in an area that paleontologists call Pterosaur Beach. And it's called that. It's this, what's today a quarry in southeastern France. But 150 million years ago, it was this lagoon with tides and this beach and everything like that. So a much different environment. And researchers have found pterosaur prints there before, but in this new study, they're reporting a set of prints that look much more unusual than the other prints that they've seen.
Something about the layout or arrangement of the prints?
Right. Pterosaurs, even though they were flying creatures, when they were on the ground, they actually walked on all fours. They used their feet and they had hands on their wings, and they put these hands down on the ground and they walked on all fours. And that leaves a very distinctive pattern in the ground. You know, with these walking tracks, you see these prints that are sort of with the left and the right feet staggered as if, you know, something's walking. But with this new set of prints that they found, and you can see a picture of these on the site, as well as an illustration of a pterosaur, what they saw was that the first set of footprints were side by side, directly side by side. So they weren't staggered at all. And also they saw what looked like this dragging pattern where the toes of the feet were sort of seemed to be dragging along the sand. And that suggested to the researchers that there was a lot of forward momentum happening, as if the pterosaurs had hit the ground going at some speed forward. And therefore, once they hit, they sort of dragged their toes a little bit.
So this would really help researchers better understand the mechanisms of early flight by flying lizards.
Exactly. And actually, the patterns that they see from this pterosaur, you know, runway, if you will, are very similar to the patterns that researchers see with living birds. Something called the merganser duck makes similar patterns. And what's interesting about this duck is it has this sort of complicated flying pattern where it stalls in midair before it lands. And it looks like the pterosaurs were doing the same thing, which means that they were actually very adept flyers, something that's been a question by scientists. How agile were these guys in the air? And it turns out, at least from this limited evidence, they actually seem to be fairly agile flyers.
Limited evidence. This is just one set of prints?
Yes, it's just one set of prints.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into a story about rice plants that snorkel and how people really will walk in circles if they don't have anything to guide them. And for the science policy blog, Science Insider, we're looking into a story about whale protection and also a story about Francis Collins becoming the new director of NIH and what some of his first priorities are going to be once he gets started. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.